In this second hour of Midday, Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal joins us for another edition of Midday on the Bay. Today, a follow-up to a story we covered earlier, why it has taken 40 years for the small eastern shore towns of Greensboro and Goldsboro to finally get off antiquated, failing sewage systems that polluted local waters, including the Choptank River. And speaking of time, we'll also hear from Donald Marsh, a Harvard Business School graduate turned oyster farmer who has waited several years to get a permit to grow oysters in a coastal area near Ocean City. Plus, environmentalists are calling for a moratorium on new chicken houses on Maryland's eastern shore. We'll hear why during the coming hour, Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell after the news. I like to say Shana Tova. Shana Tova?
Shana Tova.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
I've said that every year, and I always have to ask that how you pronounce that. It's basically Happy New Year, isn't it?
Happy New Year. Happy Jewish New Year.
On Rosh Hashanah.
Yes.
And so I say that to you, Rona Cabell, and all our Jewish listeners today.
Happy 5776.
5776. Rona Cabell is with us. Rona Cabell, reporter with the Chesapeake Bay Journal, who joins us once a month here on Midday on the Bay to talk about environmental news, news from the Grand Chesapeake watershed. And we have three or four stories to cover today, one about a couple of Eastern Shore towns that have had trouble with their sewage for a long time and have polluted local waterways, finally getting their act together over there and coming up with a new wastewater treatment plant and hooking up a town that has had a failing septic system for a long time. So that's a follow-up on a story we've covered earlier with Rona. We'll get to in just a minute. We're also going to meet today, at least by phone, Don Marsh, or Donald Marsh, a Harvard Business School graduate turned oyster farmer who had a lot of trouble getting permits to do oyster farming in Maryland in the coastal area near Ocean City. So we're going to get to talk with him. You think it took him actually 7 years to get permits?
7 years, yeah.
Is that the calculation?
Wow. Yes.
Wow.
I think officially five, but he started working on it 2 years before his application. And it is quite a saga. A lot of oyster farmers have waited a long time for permits. I don't think anyone's waited longer than he has.
We're also going to hear about a pitch from a group of environmentalists, environmental organizations, who want the state of Maryland to stop allowing chicken farming on the Eastern Shore. New chicken farming.
New chicken
houses. No expansion of chicken or poultry houses on the Eastern Shore. We're going to hear their reasons for stating that. And also, in environmental news, Rona has a little bit on Donald Trump, too. Donald Trump even manages to noodle his way into this show. So so let's start with the two towns of Greensboro and Goldsboro. In Caroline County on the Eastern Shore, this is a follow-up to a story we've covered with you earlier, Rona.
Right. So this is not the part of the Eastern Shore that many of the listeners have visited. This is not St. Michael's. This is not Oxford. This is the northern part of Caroline County. It's a bit of a forlorn section of Caroline County, the upper part of the Choptank River, a lot of farms. And there are four towns up there that have been on failing septic systems for quite a long time. They're small towns. They're lower middle class towns for the most part, and they have struggled for a long time to find a solution to their failing septic problem.
And their septic problem becomes the problem of the Chesapeake Bay ultimately, right?
Ultimately, yes.
Because their failing systems get into the Choptank and then gets into the Chesapeake, bringing nutrients into the bay.
Right. So what happens with a failing septic is usually the yard is not large enough to control the waste. The waste is sort of sprinkled in the yard and it sort of seeps down. And in this case, their waste is going right into the ditches that flow into the Choptank. And when I say their waste, I mean not only their waste, but also their dishwater from washing dishes and running dishwashers and all that. It's all combining and going down into the ditches that then take it into the Choptank River.
Now, there are two towns in particular we're going to talk about with you today, Rona. One is Greensboro. We'll get to Greensboro in just a minute. But Goldsboro is the town we talked about with you when you first reported on this, because Goldsboro has these failing systems. It's a tiny town, and they were really polluting the Lake Bonney, right?
Right.
Which was a sort of a resort area one time, right?
Right. It was a private campground that goes back 50 years, and it was a dammed up part of the Choptank River that formed Lake Bonney, and it was a popular place for all kinds of people from Delaware and Maryland to go and kind of nice blue fishing and camping and a nice community of people who'd go back every year. And in the 1990s, the woman who owns the lake was forced to shut down the lake. Gail Litz was forced to shut down the lake, and she kept her campground kind of limping along for the next 12 years. And then in 2010, she lost her lake to foreclosure. And the reason that they had to shut it down, the stated reason, was contamination from the septic systems of Goldsboro. That was what was causing the pollution in the lake. And there was nothing that she could really do. She thought about dredging, but while the septic systems were still failing, there was nothing she could do to fix it.
So people weren't coming there and using her campgrounds anymore?
But when the lake got polluted, she tried really hard to make something else happen. She investigated a water park and some other things, but not really. I mean, I probably wouldn't want to go camping at a lake where I couldn't swim. And
that's what I mean. I was trying to get at what the financial problems were. She had financial problems separate from Lake Bonney problems, or they're entwined?
I don't believe they were separate. I think she lived on the lake, and that was her income, and that was her property, and she couldn't make it work anymore. She couldn't even sustain the few people who'd come back year after year.
And then the problem in Goldsboro was that there were so few people living there and yet causing problems with these failing septic systems. They couldn't afford a hookup, right, to the local town's wastewater treatment plant. Is that right?
Right. So the Maryland Department of the Environment, the year after the lake closed in 1997, entered into a consent order with Goldsboro. And that basically meant Goldsboro agreed that it was going to do something about its waste. And if it didn't, the MDE was going to fine them $100 a day. MDE never fined them anything, and Goldsboro never fixed the problem. And the reason for that is that wastewater treatment systems are extremely expensive. And here in Baltimore, we share that cost with 2 million other people. But if you're in a town of 100 people, you share that cost with 100 people. So $20 million split among 100 people is a lot of money. $20 million split among 2 million people. And of course, like, the Back River sewage treatment plant costs more than that to maintain and upgrade. But even a small wastewater treatment plant is very expensive, and they could never afford it. I mean, a water bill of, $100, $200 a quarter would jump into the thousands, and there was just no way that they could pay for it. So over the years, there were many solutions that were sort of batted around. At one point, a developer wanted to build 500 new homes in Goldsboro, and he was going to put in a treatment plant. And that got scuttled because of the economy tanking, and also because that particular developer wasn't willing to hook in the other towns. And it's not really worth it if you're not going to solve the problem for all four towns.
What are the four towns, by the way?
So it's Goldsboro, Henderson, Templeville, and Mary Dell.
Okay.
And complicating matters, Mary Dell is half in Delaware and half in Maryland. And the Delaware part, according to the Delaware Department of Environment, the Delaware part is fine. The lots are large enough that the septics don't fail. So if and when Mary Dell does get hooked up, it will only be the Maryland side that will go into the Maryland wastewater plant.
The hookup that we're talking about would have been to the town of Greensboro, right? Where
right.
there was a wastewater treatment plant, yet an antiquated one, but still a wastewater treatment plant. So the hookup you're talking about would have cost all that money, would have been to Greensboro.
Well, Dan, actually, the Greensboro hookup is a bit of a newer idea.
Oh.
The past ideas were to build Goldsboro its own system.
Ah.
And then there was an idea hatched by the late mayor of Denton, Brad Horsey, to hook up Denton's wastewater plant to Goldsboro and basically go under the Choptank River and hook in. And that was scuttled because nobody wanted a sewage problem in the Choptank River, a bigger sewage problem, that is. So over the years, there were lots of very smart people trying to solve this problem. And the best they could come up with was Greensboro is a larger town of about 2,000 people, and Greensboro's system, like many systems, was outdated. So it was decided that when Greensboro got its new system, Goldsboro could then hook in. And initially, they wanted all four of the towns to hook in, but they didn't have enough money. So it's a $19 million treatment for the two towns instead of a $32 million one for all four.
Question for you. So we've had a so-called flush tax in Maryland since the Ehrlich administration.
Right.
Wouldn't that money have helped speed this process up? The period you're talking about is like 40 years now. So something is finally happening. Actually, hold on, folks, because Rona does have some good news to report. But wouldn't the flesh tax money have helped those little towns hook into Greensboro?
Actually, it's a great question, and that's the question that I had that vexed me so much, because Maryland is a state that gets much praise for all we've done with wastewater. Chicken stuff is another story, but you know, we tend to be progressive about wastewater treatment, and the reason is that when the flush fee was set up, it was set up to upgrade sewage treatment plants. It wasn't really set up to deal with septics, and if you remember, the septic people had fought bitterly about having to pay it. And a compromise was reached that septic system users would have to pay, and the fund that they paid into would go to upgrade individual septic systems and also for cover crops. So if you have a failing septic, you can upgrade your failing septic. But if you want to hook up your whole town of 100 people on failing septics into a sewage system, there was no money for that for a long time.
You just mentioned cover crops in passing. Someone might wonder, why were cover crops funded under that?
Oh, that's a really good point. Sorry.
just make sure we understand why that was included in the benefits from the flush tax.
So cover crops soak up the nitrogen when land is fallow, and there's never quite enough money for all the farmers who want to participate in the cover crop program because it's pretty popular. So the idea was, these are rural people. Let's give them a benefit that befits a rural part of the country, so that the septic system money would go to cover crops, a way for rural pollution to be controlled. So that's why they did it that way.
To be absorbed.
Yes.
Okay. So Greensboro finally gets some money from the flush tax for wastewater upgrade.
Right.
And that's what's happening now?
Right. And Rich Hall and Bob Summers and others in the past administration worked really hard to structure this deal so that they could, because this is a fairly unusual thing to hook up a town and potentially several towns into a new wastewater system. And we have other towns in Maryland, like Barclay, which has a failing septic. It's up in northern Queen Anne's County, that would like to adopt this model and hook into plants in more developed parts.
Okay, so Greensboro gets a new wastewater treatment plant?
Right.
And this project includes hookups to the town of Goldsboro?
Right.
Wow.
It would be...
How much is that costing the state?
It would be better if the towns didn't have such similar names, right? It's going to be a $19 million plant, and their bills are going to go up a fair amount. But from what I've heard from the price that the bill is going to go up, it's not as crazy as in some other places. I think they're going to be paying like $220 a quarter, whereas in the Shenandoah Valley, just for a comparison, the Shenandoah Valley had a few towns that had these old lagoon systems that are constantly overflowing and, you know, just terrible for the water. And they had to get new sewage treatment plants, and they were smaller towns, and some of them managed to partner together, but a lot of them couldn't manage to work that out. So a town of, you know, 1,500 people had to put in a $20 million wastewater plant, and the bill went up from, you know, $150 a month to $20 a month to like $150, and you know, the sewage hookup fees went up, and those politicians were voted out of office because it was so unpopular. So this is a very delicate issue, and you have to tread really carefully and explain it very clearly to people. And from what I talked to from the public officials in Goldsboro, they felt that the people in their community really understood and supported the idea, even though it was going to cost them a lot more.
Okay. And what of Lake Bonnie? What might happen to Lake Bonnie? Do you have any idea?
Well, I talked to Gail Litz, who owns the lake, and she said that, you know, one possible outcome could be that once this hookup occurs, and it's going to be a few years before it does, you could drain and dredge the lake and refill it, but that would cost a few million dollars, and I would think that you would need to get some state support to do that for the new owner.
All the beefing about the flush tax, remember?
Yes.
It did pass and has been in place, and this is a successful program in Maryland.
Absolutely. And not only the flush fee, but the septic piece of it, and also the Bay Restoration Fund. The thing about these urban problems is that you put money into them and they do get fixed. if you have money, you can fix them. I mean, there some pollution problems are really intractable, and it's so hard to solve them. But sewage treatment and septic and even stormwater are, if you can invest in the problem, you can fix it. And so there's always resistance because nobody wants to pay, and there's never enough money. But I think the payoff is that you'll get better water quality.
That's what's expected, right, from the Greensboro plant.
Right.
To reduce nutrients going into the chop tank a great deal.
And that's the headwaters of the chop tank, too. And that's where the water of the chop tank is in the worst shape.
We should mention, as of July 2014, the state comptroller had deposited $620 million in the state's wastewater treatment plant fund, $83 million in the septic upgrade fund that Rona is referring to, and $64 million in the Department of Agriculture's fund for cover crops. So that's where your money's been going to with this flush fee. And it's upgraded, I don't know how many wastewater treatment plants around the state from the Eastern Shore to Western Maryland by now.
65 of the big ones, and now they're working on the smaller ones.
I knew you would know that. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. This is Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here. You're welcome to join us at any time you have a comment or question. 410-662-8780. Oyster farming when we get back. And oyster farming is sort of the hard way. It took a lot of patience and perseverance for Don Marsh to get up and running as an oyster farmer in Maryland. We're going to be speaking with him. If you have any comments or questions, again, our number 410-662-8780. And welcome back, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. It's Midday on the Bay, our monthly visit with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You can get a free subscription to the Chesapeake Bay Journal just by going online, bayjournal.com.
Bayjournal.com. Hit subscribe.
Yeah. So, Rona, before we get Don Marsh on the phone with us, give us the background of this gentleman and his ambitions in Maryland for oyster farming.
Well, Don Marsh wanted to farm oysters in the coastal bays of Maryland, and he applied for a permit, about 5 or 6 years ago. Before that, he was already planning it for a year or so before that. And in Maryland, you need a permit from the Department of Natural Resources, which has a process set up. And then you need another permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. And this is where a lot of oyster farmers run into frustration, because it takes the Army Corps of Engineers a really long time to issue a permit, sometimes 5 years. And Don went to court, and he prevailed at court, and he got his permit from the state. And I think he's finally gotten his permit from the Army Corps as well and is ready to farm oysters. But what I think is interesting is every oyster farmer I talk to tells me that growing oysters is the easy part of oyster farming. The hard part is all the bureaucratic processes that you have to go through, and sometimes you have to go through them again and again and again.
And the area we're talking about, and we'll speak with Don in a moment, you say coastal area. This is a bay area is around Ocean City on that
right.
side of the state, not
right.
on the bay side.
This is not Chesapeake Bay, which
right.
I think might make Don Marsh's case a little different. There's another farmer in the coastal bays named Steve Gordon, who I wrote about in 2006, and he too spent a lot of time getting a permit to grow oysters and clams in the coastal bays. And he, like Don Marsh, encountered a lot of resistance from his neighbors. And the people who oppose oyster farming are able to use this process in place by the Army Corps and to some extent by DNR to protest the lease and then to sort of tie it up in court for a long time.
Well, let's get Don Marsh on the phone and welcome him to the Midday Show, Midday on the Bay. Don, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
I just want a little background for our listeners here, a little bit of background on you, your background and how you got into oyster farming and why.
Well, which first? I guess the background would be in brief. I've been a businessman all of my life. I've been employed in one way or another since I was about 14. I have a college degree and a master's degree, and in 2008, semi-retired as a consequence of selling a business that I was for which I served as the CFO and in some cases chief operating officer. So I got involved in aquaculture through an interest that I have in just conservation, environmental conservation, and so on. The Assateague Coastal Trust had a program for restoration of oysters in the coastal bays. And I was interested in the coastal bays, having purchased some property near a place called Newport Bay. And so I looked into that program and found it both physically interesting and intellectually interesting and so on. And so I volunteered for that program. That's how I got started in my interest in aquaculture. That program no longer exists, but I continued to follow my instincts there and saw the coastal bays as a very, very interesting and exciting place to work on the process of restoring oysters to the bay. That's what got me going.
And the coastal area, because you had property, you said, in Newport Bay, this is down, we want to describe where that is for folks who've been to Ocean City or Assateague. Where is that, Don?
Well, as you probably know, there are a series of coastal bays, and Chincoteague Bay is, you know, the famous bay where the wild horses live on the sand dunes and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Newport Bay is a subset of the Chincoteague Bay on the western side of the Chincoteague Bay.
And when you got into this, was anyone doing any oyster farming in that area?
Not really. You may know, there was one individual who I got to know quite well by the name of Steve Gordon, who has an oyster nursery and clam nursery. That's probably the subject of another show, what an oyster nursery is and a clam nursery. But he had been he had some similar problems to mine. And so I got connected with him, and he was putting clams in the water, but not any oysters. So I guess that's a long answer, a long way of saying no. I'm kind of the
pioneer.
Yeah.
I call you a pioneer, Don, okay?
Yeah, but some of the same trials and tribulations that other pioneers have had.
So we started off talking with Rona about your problems, and that required so much patience and perseverance. It's been almost 7 years since the time you first took an interest in this. I guess I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, or the seaweed, but folks would probably want to know what took so long.
Yeah, well, that's a difficult question to answer in a simple way. There are a variety of factors that seem to conspire to make the process a very difficult one. First, you have an agency of state government, and when I started, there were several agencies of state government, all trying to coordinate things amongst themselves. And then secondly, you have the Army Corps of Engineers, which has its own, each office of the Corps, and mine was centered in the Baltimore office, seem to have their own sort of distinct policies and practices as to how they approach the issue of aquaculture. And then they have to coordinate their efforts with the state, and sometimes that leaves something to be desired. So you have that sort of thing going on. In my case, I had this issue of several people who could see from their property where they have either vacation homes or residences, they could see where my site was, which is about a half mile offshore. And they decided it was going to be threatening to them in many ways. I don't know how they came to that decision, but they did. And so they made a concerted effort to thwart my desire, my effort to put together an aquaculture project. And they exerted as much pressure as they could on authorities. And I think they had a significant effect of slowing things down.
Don, what yeah. would people see? If you had a spot, you said, what did you say, a half a mile offshore?
Yep. It's a little less than half a mile offshore.
Okay.
That's right. It's
Chincoteague Bay.
Yes.
So what would people see? Would they see those floats that we associate with oyster farming?
No. Actually, the project that I designed with some help is a project where oysters are kept in vinyl-coated wire cages that rest on the seafloor. And those cages extend about 12 inches above the seafloor, and they're in 4 feet of water. So they're completely submerged. And the only thing that could be visible of the farm itself would be buoys that I'm required to place at the corners of the lease. And those buoys are just standard Coast Guard buoys about the size of a basketball. And from a half mile away, it's unlikely that anyone can see them, but it's possible that someone might see those. The other thing is, of course, if I'm there in a boat, they'll see me in a boat.
Right. But okay, a boat in a bay is not an unusual sight. One more question for me, and then Rona had a couple questions for you, Don. How did you pick the location of this farm? And when you mentioned lease, with whom is the lease attained?
Okay, well, the first answer as to whom the lease is obtained, that's from the Department of Natural Resources of the state of Maryland.
Okay.
And if somebody had an interest in doing so, they just look up DNR on the website, the state website, and search aquaculture, and the whole thing comes up as to how to go about doing it. As to my selection of the site, there's several reasons. Of course, one is that I live nearby there. The second is that reading through some of the literature on the historic culture of oysters, I discovered that the Chincoteague Bay historically was known as the location of the finest oysters grown in the country. So that was somewhat supportive, assuming that Chincoteague Bay still resembles what it once did, which I think it does. And then thirdly, the state of Maryland, under the auspices of a scientist by the name of Mitchell Tarnowski, did a comprehensive survey of all of the coastal bay in Maryland with the specific purposes of identifying those locations that would be best suited for aquaculture. And he put together a series of different criteria, including water quality, weather conditions, proximity to markets, interference with such things as recreation, navigation, commercial fishing, and so on. And this area where I selected turns out to be his first choice as the best place to raise oysters in the coastal bays. So those are the reasons why I chose that area.
Okay, and how large an area was this?
Originally, I had identified about 50 acres that I wanted to lease. That was subsequently, after many exhaustive meetings with the Army Corps, whittled down to about 18, which is where it currently stands.
Rona.
I just wanted to maybe explain something for listeners who aren't as obsessed with oysters as I am, that there's basically three different ways in Maryland that we grow oysters in aquaculture. One is spat on shell on the bottom. The other one is, as Don's using, cages that are about 12 inches from the bottom. And then the third way, and by far the least popular way for neighbors, is floats that you can see. So I guess, Don, I just wanted to know, with your cage system in place on your leases, would people still be able to use the waterway? Would they be able to boat over your lease and swim over your lease? And was that a concern?
Well, that's a good question, Rona. And I think anybody who's going to do something like this has to think about the impact that it has on others. And I tried to do that. One of the things that I did when I was first trying to site the thing was I assumed that there would be boats going around, although this area has minimal boat traffic. But still, there's going to be some. And nobody wants to catch the propeller on something or run into something in their boat, you know, as they're going along. So I went along and I took a layperson survey of the docks in the area and the boats in the area. And I wrote those down and looked up on the internet what kind of draft those boats required. And none of them required more than 3 feet. So I felt that with a cage height of a foot and 3 feet of water above that, that anybody, you know, in their boat could go over my cages and be secure. So I looked for a spot where, at low tide, there'd be 4 feet of water, and that's how I selected it.
You know, well, I guess something of concern here is, in your story, and this taking so long, it sounds like, you know, attorneys were involved, that this got to be expensive for you, more expensive maybe than we want oyster farming to be at the outset for people. So I wonder if you'd comment on that, Don, because it seems, based on the stories Rona's been telling us on this show over the years and that we've read in the Chesapeake Bay Journal and the Baltimore Sun, that oyster farming is not, it's not out of the question for someone who has that ambition to get into this.
So here's the deal. You know, oysters are a terrific product, as I don't need to tell anybody that. Everybody in Maryland understands that oysters are great for a lot of reasons. And oyster farming is a very interesting thing. It can be complicated, but fundamentally it's not that complicated. And there are plenty of people around, employed by the state and elsewhere, who will help an individual get into the business. The economics are quite good. It's healthy, and the product is great, and you can make some money at it. There are risks, of course, like in any business, and some of them are fairly severe, but you can make money at it. So the average guy who wants to work outside, do something very productive, make some money at it, has a terrific opportunity. And that is exactly what the state intended when it went through a very comprehensive process to enact legislation enabling this. The problem is that people take advantage of the processes of government, the procedures, and the courts to assert arguments that are then addressed endlessly by the courts and by the agencies of government, and without really intending to do anything particularly purposeful other than delay. So a young man or woman with ambitions to do this and a limited budget and a need to do something within a reasonable time gets thwarted by people who subvert the system. That's fundamentally what goes on.
Rona, didn't Senator Ben Cardin address this recently?
Yes, and Don was at the meeting that we had at Horn Point where he talked about this. And one of the things that comes up over and over again in addressing this issue is that Virginia has a different process. Virginia also has a state agency that governs aquaculture, and it also has a Corps of Engineers. But in Virginia, it takes about 3 months to get an oyster permit, and it costs a lot less than what Don has spent on his oyster permit. And as a result, in Virginia, you have a diversity of guys. Well, I'd say guys. It's mostly men who are farming oysters. I've talked to anyone from retired watermen to retired police officers. And you get this real diverse group of people who are raising oysters, and they have a huge aquaculture industry, and it is the envy of almost every state, including Maryland. And Maryland is consistently asking, how can we have what Virginia has? And when they asked Cardin at that meeting, the answer was, get the Army Corps to issue these permits in a more timely manner. And at the moment, we have a new Army Corps commander, Colonel Chamberlain, and we had invited him to come on the show, but he decided that he wanted to defer it until later because he wanted to work some things out. And so I think Senator Cardin was hopeful that maybe we have an opportunity now to move forward so that future oyster farmers don't have to go through what Don Marsh went through.
Well, Don, do you think your situation was unique? I asked Rona, too. Was it unique because of the opposition of neighbors? Would you say that was the main thing that held this up?
Well, I don't know that that was the main thing, sir, but it was certainly a big piece of it because these people are very coordinated, and there are attorneys who have specialized in this field, and they have their basic complaint already drafted beforehand, and it's the complaint that they file in every case, and the court hears every case as if it were the first time. So that is a big piece of it. I think the other part of it, and I think Colonel Chamberlain has a tremendous opportunity, and he appears to be intent on doing the right thing here, but he has a tremendous opportunity to change the process at the Army Corps. The state of Maryland changed its process and streamlined it, made it much more efficient over the course of the last 5 years. Army Corps could do an enormous amount with a relatively modest set of changes. I think he's open to considering those, and I hope he'll actually do some of it. But right now, the process at the Army Corps is too complex for any mortal of even high intelligence to manage. It's just too much.
I'm struck by another oyster farmer I know who's been on our show before, John Farrington, who was one of the real pioneers. He started his oyster farm back in 2005, and he told me that it was the same process to get a permit for an oyster operation. In his case, it was a spat on shell operation, the same process as you would go through to put in an oil derrick. So, I mean, they had basically a sort of a one-size-fits-all application for structures in the water. And, you know, cages and floats are something to reckon with, but spat on shell really is not a structure in the water.
Don Marsh, we just have a couple minutes left with you, so I want to know, where do things stand today? Are you farming, or what are your plans? And if you get into this trade, well, you're into this trade, once you start trading or marketing your oysters, how will we know you? What will be your trade name?
Well, the name of my company is South Point Oyster Farm, LLC. The brand, at least one brand that I've created, is the Pirate Island brand. And that's from a name of an island that's located not very far from where my oyster lease is located. So we will have the Pirate Island brand of oysters. And the status of it right now is that I actually, about 3 days ago, received the final permit signed from the Army Corps of Engineers. And I have the lease. I've had the lease from the state for about a year and a half. And then I need to get what I hope will be a relatively standard procedure from the Coast Guard to tell me what buoys I need to put on the corners and whether I have to light those buoys and so on and so forth. But that should not be, I hate to say that.
Another bureaucratic agency.
A drawn-out process.
Right.
I think it would be a process. So right now I'm not yet doing it, but any minute now.
So the Pirate Island brand, will that those be real Chincoteague oysters from Chincoteague Bay?
They will be the best oysters in the world.
Okay. Well, we wish you luck, Don Marsh. After all this time, congratulations on getting your permits and getting rolling.
Well, I'll extend the offer to you as well, as I have to Rona, that as soon as I am rolling, you can test my claim by my giving you a batch of oysters to try.
The Pirate Island oysters with what kind of beer would you recommend with the Pirate Island oyster? There must be a pirate kind of beer out there, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dogfish Head, right?
We'll figure this out. Don, thank you very much and good luck to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for getting them on the show with us, Rona. Don Marsh, South Point Oyster Company, soon trading as, whenever he starts harvesting oysters, Pirate Island oysters.
You should call them something like Long Wait or something like
something that addresses
finally
the 7 years it took for him to get a permit.
7 year itch.
All right, we'll take another break here. When we come back, an environmentalist group or groups wants Maryland to stop the expansion of poultry farming on the Eastern Shore, a moratorium on new chicken houses. And also, we'll tell you about Donald Trump and the Potomac River.
Is yes.
Yeah. We got a Donald Trump story for you. 410-662-8780 is the number for midday if you have any questions for Rona Cabell. And welcome back, everyone. Midday on the Bay, Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. The Environmental Integrity Project put out a report a few months ago about, we talked about this as well on Midday on the Bay, the effects of chicken manure on fields, farm fields on the Eastern Shore, and a coalition of environmental groups now calling for a moratorium, not on chicken farming, but a moratorium on the expansion of chicken farming, right? The addition of more chicken houses on Maryland's Eastern Shore.
So there's been a change that's taken place, I think, fairly rapidly in chicken farming on the Eastern Shore and in the whole country. And that is, we sort of had this model where you'd have chicken farmer, chicken farmer's wife, 500 acres, The guy had a job off farm. The woman stayed home and raised the chickens. They had maybe two chicken houses, maybe three. And now we're moving to this model of no land and 8, 10, 12 chicken houses. And these are large chicken houses that raise probably 200,000 birds a year. When I was out in Arkansas, I saw quite a bit of this. And the people running the farms are not necessarily native to the area in which they raise the birds. And often they don't even live on the farm, but they're from out of state or out of country. And they see this as a way to make money. And the chicken farmers, the chicken farm companies like the Purdue's and the Tyson's and the Mount Airs are encouraging this because it increases efficiency and it makes the chicken trucks have to go to fewer places to pick up the birds. And so, and there's financing available for it, and there's kind of a whole push behind it. So we're seeing these counties on the Eastern Shore that really were rural in every sense, becoming more like a factory type of atmosphere where you're moving next to a place that has 10 chicken houses and no land. It's not really so much a farm anymore. It's more of an industrial facility.
So that's interesting. So bigger facilities on less land. From the outset, less investment because you don't have to buy as much land.
Right.
So we had this report from the Environmental Integrity Project talking about land. It was talking about the saturation of all these nutrients from chicken manure on the land.
Right. And so basically we've known for a long time, and the report also told us that we have fields on the Eastern Shore that have taken on so much manure that they cannot accept any more. And so we take the manure and we move it around the Delmarva Peninsula basically to farms that are less saturated. Eventually, those farms will become more saturated. And the latest report from the Environmental Integrity Project, the one that concluded that we needed a chicken farm moratorium, basically said, not only have we cut back on the monitoring stations for the waterways on the Eastern Shore because of cuts in federal funding, but we're also expanding the chicken houses that we have on the shore. And so we're never going to know if the controls that we've put in to clean the water, which is this phosphorus management tool, which is the limit on how much phosphorus we can put on fields, we're never going to know if that worked because we don't have a baseline anymore, because we're we're growing so many new chicken farms that by the time it comes around 2024, we're going to have so much more manure.
So this trend that you're talking about is real. Have you measured it to see how many new chicken houses are in the pipeline?
Well, I haven't measured it for the whole Eastern Shore, but in Somerset County alone, we're talking about 70 new houses, I think, over the last year and a half that have been permitted, and some of them have been built. And
does the state have a limit on it?
No.
Does the Maryland Department of Environment or the Department of Agriculture say, we can only issue so many permits for new chicken houses?
There's no limit on the CAFO permit process. And the thing that's kind of interesting about this is that these are local zoning decisions. So the Maryland Department of the Environment doesn't have a sort of, here's what you need for a chicken farm. Each county on the Eastern Shore has its own zoning. So, you know, it can be, you know, 10 acres or 20 acres or 30 acres is the minimum. And you need this many trees and it has to have this big a setback. And so they each have their own
rules.
Their own rules.
Zoning
but
rules.
The thing that I find interesting is these rules were written at a time when the zoning is called residential agricultural. So it was written at a time when you had the husband, wife, 500 acres, two chicken houses. And now you're just moving into a whole new environment where that paradigm is gone. And so the zoning regulations haven't kept up with that. And so in Somerset County in particular, but probably going to be going into these other counties too, a group of people have formed that have basically said, you know, you need to change the zoning. You need to protect human health and you need to protect our property. And, you know, we can't have this situation.
Well, it's not just the manure and the land. Environmentally speaking or atmospherically speaking, if you live near those places, you smell ammonia a lot of the time, right?
The ammonia.
I mean, it gets pretty bad.
The ammonia is really, really intense.
So you're seeing there's some of that resistance, too, to this.
Well, the Center for Livable Future and Dr. Robert Lawrence
at
Johns Hopkins and Keeve Nachman have been the ones who have been really out front. And Kathy Phillips of the Assateague Coast Keeper have been the ones really out front talking about the human health issue with the air quality and the, I mean, I was in Somerset County about a year ago reporting this story, and I went down to a street where there are about 60 or 70 new chicken houses and five standalone private homes. two of which were bought by the state. One is now a group home. But there were a couple private residents still there, and I couldn't really breathe. I mean, it was a lot, and my eyes were tearing up. And people who walk there at night say they see so much dust in the air from all the dander. And it's, I mean, it, you know, you're creating a situation.
Is there any chance that we'll see a moratorium? The state would put in some kind of limits? Or the local, I get you, it's local zoning, isn't it?
Yeah, I highly doubt that there is going to be a chicken moratorium, because chicken is the engine of the Eastern Shore economy. And actually,
how much can it grow, though? That's the question, right? Well, without influencing, or in a negative way, human life around it.
How much do we want cheap chicken? I think what I've heard from and seen from the USDA is the consumption of beef and pork is down, but the consumption of chicken is up, and people want chicken. And I wouldn't necessarily want to operate a chicken farm, but it's a good business to be in. You can make a good amount of money, and there's a lot of opportunity up front for financing of chicken houses and that kind of thing. So I think it can continue to grow. If there's no controls on it, it can continue to grow plenty. But I think that what these groups have done is gotten the attention of the state and the regulators, and maybe we'll see some curbs on how we're growing it.
We'll pick up on that again another day, see if anything comes of it. I don't want to leave this show without getting our Donald Trump in here. So we have a Donald Trump Potomac River story.
We do. So a few years ago, Donald Trump cleared thousands of trees along the Potomac River in one of the last...
On land he owned,
on
right?
land he owned, that was the last... It's the only part of the view shed of that part of the Potomac from D.C. to Harper's Ferry that is completely devoid of trees. And he proudly and boastfully said, you know, I didn't come here, you know, for a forested...
I want to see the river.
Potomac River.
I want to see the river.
I want a golf course. You know, I want to be able to, you know, have the best golf course in the whole world. So he built this golf course.
Is it a private golf course?
It's a private golf course. He owns it. But the issue is that he didn't have permission to clear the trees. He had to get permission from the county to clear the trees. And had it been in, I mean, he got permission eventually, but at first he had to get like a special...
Was he on the Virginia side?
Yes. So this is in Loudoun County. So Loudoun County does not have a Chesapeake Bay ordinance to protect the water. Fairfax County does. And so the Potomac River Conservancy has made this point that if he had been in Fairfax County, he wouldn't have been able to do this. And trying to get Loudoun County to put in some more protections. And so they got this... They're using the Trump moment to sort of get...
To say you need to put some controls on people,
right.
Even on private property, cutting right. down all these trees, because it is a watershed.
And
right?
we should say that
it is the nation's river.
Trump isn't the only billionaire to do this. Dan Snyder, who owns
right.
the Washington
Redskins.
Football
yeah, he
team,
did
he did it too. So I think the point they're trying to make is that if you have money, you can get permission to do things that other people aren't allowed to do. And in the case of Trump, you know, he cleared many thousands of trees. So.
There's a story about this, Donald Trump and the trees along the Potomac, on the BayJournal.com website. Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal joins us here for Midday on the Bay. You're going to be back in another week or so, too.
Yes,
right?
We'll be back talking about Towson green space.
I asked about a good beer to go with Pirate Island oysters, and Carol says, anything from local craft brewery Heavy Seas, which has a pirate theme, Loose Cannon, my favorite, she says, Cutlass, Crossbones, Small Craft. You get the idea. Cheers and arg. So thank you, Carol. Thank you, Rona.
Thank you very
much. And Shana Tova again to you.
Shana Tova. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. Glad you could join us today for Midday. See you again tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.